Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We have merged the streams here in and around a very contentious election season with COVID on the rise and Ravens football on our brain. We've mixed the sports with the rest of the world because it's all one big thing. It's all brought to you by our friends at Taharka, where you can still eat this vanilla bean ice cream. And we're going to be giving you a code beginning next week for the holidays to ship some holiday ice cream, some peppermint bark, and some eggnog, some pumpkin spice latte, which has become my favorite, to you. Taharka sponsoring Baltimore Positive, as well as our friends at El Guapo. I got the shirt on. I just do that to make Don angry. Don, if you
don't want my shirt.
Evan Brown is the guy.
I want my shirt.
You know, my wife and I have been talking about getting back over there and checking out some of those carnitas, amongst other things, and some margaritas. El Guapo is now open in the 21228. Don can walk there from his place on a nice 64-degree fall morning or afternoon. And, of course, our friends at State Fair across the street with the chicken and waffles, the shrimp and grits, all the things that we miss about hanging out with our guests, whether it was Westmore, whether it's Sarah Heminger. All of that stuff is out now at Baltimore Positive in various ways, including some of our alums around here. We probably would have gotten together at Fadley's and had a crab cake with this guy the last time. Don, the plague has really put a hold on some of our plans, but I am thinking at this point, this election is pass-fail at this point, that I'm going back to sweatpants for the next 6 months of Baltimore Positive for guests like our next guest. How about that?
Well, we welcome former Sun editor and reporter and currently the editor of Political Maryland, must-read blog if you want to know the latest that's happening in the state of Maryland, Barry Raskovar. Barry, welcome back to Baltimore Positive. Are you still standing after a couple of election nights here?
Well, let's just put it this way, Don. I'm sitting.
I think we're all sitting. Barry, as we record this, we are in election week. We had hoped to have a result by the time we did this analysis. We do not. It's increasingly looking as if this election will come down to Pennsylvania. Is your take as we sit here, as the votes from Philadelphia and the suburbs come in, that the vice president will overtake the president's lead and eventually get to the 270 votes?
Yes. The question is when, because they have about a three quarters of, as of the moment, they have 750,000 votes still to go. But it looks as though Joe Biden, with the Philadelphia area vote, will be able to have a lead eventually of at least 100,000 votes in Philadelphia. It looks as though in Arizona that Biden will hold on to his lead there, because at the moment the outstanding votes are from the Tucson area, which is Democratic, and also Nevada, where the bulk of the remaining votes are coming from the Las Vegas area, Democratic, again, all those casino workers. So I think really the discussion now is going to be the legal challenges to the election, and then going forward, how do you run a country that is deeply divided? How do you manage to run Washington with a deeply divided Congress? These are going to be very difficult questions to answer for the next president.
Well, the first thing will be the plague, right? Like, literally, no matter, the plague doesn't care who wins. The plague doesn't care whether who cheats and what lawyers say and however long this, that the plague is going to play into this. The hill is going to play into this because the plague's roaring back, and that's obvious as I sit here today in the aftermath of the election. The Ravens have it and the Colts have it, and I canceled my flight to Indianapolis, which any good Baltimorean would say is always a good idea.
Right. There you go. Well, Nestor, I think you're right. And I think you and Barry are both touching on really once we come up for air, and once we have a winner, and it will be a declared winner, whether the president likes that or not, the wheels of government will then begin to turn. And as you said, Nestor, the current occupant in some form or fashion is going to have to address what's happening with the pandemic. And then we move to a transition and trying to make government work. Barry, what did you make of recent reports? And I was having a flashback to Obama 1 inaugural, when widely reported Mitch McConnell had that meeting in a hotel in which he instructed Republican senators that we have one job in the next 4 years, and that's to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president. Now, he did not do that, but other than health care, he did pretty much create total gridlock. Now McConnell has evidently sent signals that don't eat, which I think, and you're the historian, I always call you the professor, you're the historian. I don't remember a Senate majority leader in the past saying, don't send us any liberal or progressive cabinet members because they're dead on arrival. My recollection, Barry, is that even if it's grudgingly, the opposition party has usually taken the approach that unless a cabinet member is overtly corrupt or overtly incompetent, that they say that the president's entitled to his own team. It appears to me that McConnell is now trying to rewrite that book as well. Am I right, wrong? Fill in the blanks there, Barry.
Yeah, this really began in the 1990s when Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House and Republicans controlled the House. And he came up with his contract with America. Democrats call it a contract on America. But at that point, the Gingrich game plan was to demonize all Democrats and anybody who disagreed with the conservative Republican viewpoint that he brought to the speakership. And that really started the poisoning of the well in Washington. To the point that McConnell was able to once he became majority leader in the Senate, to basically block any liberal legislation from Barack Obama, to block a Supreme Court justice who was a moderate as far as his judicial philosophy, but that wasn't good enough for McConnell. What has changed now, and this is, let's assume that the next president is Joe Biden. If Biden is the president, Joe Biden's closest friend in the US Senate for over 30 years was Mitch McConnell. So I think that changes the narrative immediately. And McConnell has already signaled that he understands that America has to get serious about fighting the plague, as Nestor called it. The coronavirus has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed firmly, and there has to be real leadership from Washington, which includes action by Congress. So I think you're going to have a deal, and you could well have it before Donald Trump leaves office if he's defeated. McConnell will have the votes, I would believe, to push this through, even if Trump vetoes the legislation. But come January 20th, I think immediately you're going to have discussions between the moderate new president, Joe Biden, and Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer as to what can pass the Senate as far as another stimulus package. It's not going to be the House Pelosi version of $3 trillion. But it is going to be substantial. And I think what you're going to see in a Biden administration is a willingness to work with the more moderate Republican senators. Because remember, at the least, there are going to be 48 Democratic senators. There could even conceivably be 49 or possibly 50. It's close enough so that on certain issues, a Democratic moderate president can cobble together the two extra Republican votes he needs to get a 50-50 tie in the Senate, Kamala Harris, who is the president of the Senate by law, would then break the tie. You know, that is the way I think it's going to work in Washington. The other side of the coin, though, is that the Senate still has the filibuster rule, which would mean that on any controversial issue, the conservative Republicans will easily block any compromise effort by McConnell and Biden. You know, it's going to be a fascinating situation when we get to that point, but it's going to be really nervous Nelly time between today and January the 20th.
Barry Raskevar is our guest, a one-time Sun editor now, could still be read and heard and very, very relevant here during the election season, and we're happy to have him back on. You know, you mentioned we have not said the word Trump around here much, and Don and I put a moratorium on that, I don't know, sometime back in 19, before the plague began, but for our purposes, it needs to be said, like you mentioned, how the House works, how Congress is going to work, and seeing McCain do this, and I shared that earlier, because it looks like Arizona is going to give a thumbs down to Trump, which could literally push the thing to 270 in Pennsylvania, and none of the rest of it matters. And you talked about Georgia being in play, and I think about this Loeffler, this runoff that's possible as well. But the notion that Arizona may be the one that pushes this thing, and the fact that Trump, and you've covered this forever, and you're our John Meacham around here, Barry. John's unavailable, but we'll get him one day, believe me, when he's out on his country music tour. But I would just say the notion that you and I would have been together in the late 80s or early 90s up on the fifth floor down on Calvert Street, and you know, TV's on, and all the newsroom open, and the subs, and we'd all be glued to the television, and Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan would be screaming about a crooked election like a cokehead at 3 o'clock in the morning, that it's Steinbrennerian, you know, from my sports. Angelos did crazy things. People do crazy things, but we're talking about democracy here, and I guess in the history of all of this, I can't just let that, like, chill and pass and go and mob scenes the Maricopa offices to not count ballots when their candidate's behind. So it's been a stunning couple of days. And I do want to give you some oxygen to at least recap where we are. I mean, we think Biden's going to win. We know Trump's going to have lawyers. We know he can take the Twitter and wants to send militias into places. A little perspective for what we saw 3 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday.
Okay. As I said a little earlier, I think that the winner of this election will be Joe Biden. Pennsylvania puts him over the top. Arizona and Nevada, another way of getting to the top. So I think you're going to see a Biden presidency. But this is a very divided country, bitterly divided. Now, in the history of the United States, it's interesting if you go back and look, this nation has been divided more often than it's been united. To call this country the United States of America is a misnomer. This is really the disunited states of America. And you can see this reflected in the way we run our elections. Our elections are run on a decentralized basis. So you're talking about 50 different states controlling how they run their elections. As a result, you have 50 different rules in play here. And that's what you're seeing in depth now.
That have over 250 years all been crafted to keep the minority party away, no matter which municipality it is, right?
Oh, yes. To the victor belongs the spoils. And that's still what you have today.
Yeah, we talked to Sarbanes about the Rorschach district here.
Well, we have a number of them here. We have a number of them. His is the worst, but there are a few others. But you know, each state is really splintered, Maryland included. Go to the Eastern Shore, go to Western Maryland, totally different. Each metropolitan county has a different mindset. So this is a country that oftentimes cannot get its act together And that includes presidential politics and now Washington politics. The difference is the lack of civility. And the problem going forward, if you have Donald Trump as the loser here, he is not a good loser. He will not accept that, the fact that he lost. He will try to seed in his supporters the notion that he was cheated out of the presidency. And that's going to make for a very rocky 4 years for Joe Biden. The good news is that Biden is a very calming influence on all this. And he should be able to put together enough votes when he goes to Congress to get a portion of what this country needs. But more than that, he can rule through the presidency, the power of the president, executive orders, cabinet officials running the government in a more sensible way that directly helps people. And I think that's what you're going to see going forward, that he's going to try to tone down the fist fight that's been going on between parts of Congress and the president. I think you're going to see much, much less of that. We're going to have to see how the rest of the public reacts to it, because unfortunately, we live in a social networking media era in which the rules of the road are there are no rules. And that is
you said lacking civility. When does that equal criminality? I guess that's when lacking civility, to be uncouth. I mean, I grew up in Dundalk, you know, in Archie Bunker's Dundalk. I have been called such things, but then there's criminality. You know what I mean? It's one thing to be rude. It's another thing to declare our election system fraudulent when you sit at the top of it. That happens in banana republics. That doesn't happen here historically.
Historically, things are changing, and it's not just on the right. It's not just on the Republican extreme right. You know, you have more riots after the election, senseless riots in Portland. They had to bring in the National Guard in Portland. So it's the far left and the far right just is beginning to think that somehow they can seize control with violence. And that is going to have to be addressed. It's going to have to be a major concern, because you can't run a democratic government when those who are protesting literally have a gun to your head. And that's what the extreme right and left now are beginning to do. And it's being egged on by the extreme media voices out there, which could well include Donald Trump next year, and Eric Trump, and the rest of the Trump family and crew. They're not going to go away. They're still going to be part of the problem here, not part of the solution.
Well, God, Barry, there's so much to unpack. And so many people are going to analyze it. You're going to be one that's going to be writing a lot about it. I really am looking forward to the postmortems, because what I'm struggling with, because it's hard. That's obviously why I'm struggling with it, is it's very, very easy for us to take buckets, okay, and say, all right, Trump's support is about being a racist. Trump's support's about being a racist. There certainly is a component of that. But I think, to our peril, we make a huge mistake if we say this overperformance of Donald Trump now in two elections in a row is simply about racism. I don't think it is. I think it's about a lot.
I think it's
more
a vilification of the other team and the WWE and SEC college football mindset of they are the bad guys. They'll always be the Steelers. I'll always hate them. And that's that. And the softening of that, I mean, that's what's been that. That's what I've gotten out of this. That no matter what, it could be financial or any of the other socioeconomic things, but it's just that's the other team. I would never play for them, no matter what.
Well, I think the coronavirus, the pandemic, has played a major role in the attitude of many, many people toward society, toward government, toward democracy. People feel their lives are being threatened by the virus that they wanted to go away. And yet government in Washington has essentially walked away from trying to solve the problem. But more than that, because the virus led to the economic shutdown, people now are scared to death they're going to lose their jobs. They're not going to have money to make the mortgage payment or pay the rent or put food on the table. And a lot of these tens of millions of Americans went through this 10 years ago with the Great Recession, which led to Donald Trump's victory 4 years ago. People don't trust government because government didn't work to get us out of the recession quickly, and they're not getting us out of the pandemic quickly. And I think there's a lot of anger out there. And also we have to remember, we live in a bubble here in metropolitan Baltimore. We really do. Metropolitan areas across the country are quite different from the rest of America. The outer suburbs, the rural areas, and there are lots and lots and lots of them. And, you know, they have their own set of problems that are not addressed by liberals in metropolitan areas who send people to Congress who then ignore rural America and suburban America. And consequently, you have had this great divide pop up with a lot of bitterness. And I think, you know, we're going to have to somehow bridge that gap. That the Black Lives Matter movement was gaining advocates from suburban America until it turned violent, until it turned out that there was no leadership in this movement at all. And, you know, you couldn't even ask them what they really wanted other than a Bernie Sanders-style revolution in this country. Well, you're not going to get that. There's got to be a return of the middle ground, of the centrist type of governance. That's what people really wanted. And a further point here, this election showed quite definitely that Americans are cautious people. They are scared to make big changes. And they bought into the Donald Trump line that the Democrats were going to bring about radical change to the way of life that they love.
Well, clearly, you just say the word socialism south of Orlando and, you know, you lose the election, right? Literally in Florida, if it turned on Florida.
That's right. So if you look at other races for the U.S. Senate, for the House of Representatives, for state legislatures, what you see is that Democrats made no headway. They lost ground, if anything. So, you know, even if you have a Joe Biden elected president, what the bulk of Americans were saying is that we're scared. We want our politicians to be cautious. We don't want them to be wild-eyed liberals in what they're trying to accomplish in Washington. We like our way of life. We want to enhance our way of life. And you know, at what point do the politicians get it and start to address the issues out there beyond the issues that are presented to them by people in the streets protesting the loudest?
Barry, you are touching on on topics that will be chapter and chapter and chapter in books that are about to be written. Are we, and I think we often jump to conclusions as well, right? So the flavor of the day is that Latinos deserted the Biden campaign. Well, if you dig deeper, nationwide, Joe Biden got 70% of the Latino vote, at least so far, based on exit polls. 70%.
That's kind of a shocking number when 30% of the people look like me and have kids in cages. So, they're, you know, 30 is still a big number.
But it gets even more.
For a guy
more,
who threw toilet paper to the people in Puerto Rico. Right. You know what I mean?
But like, Nestor,
there was a lot of things that could have made that more 88%, like Baltimore, right, as an example.
But here's what becomes interesting, and this is where, again, the professor can weigh in. If you begin to dig down, there is a headline this morning in the New York Times, and Barry, I'm sure you've read it, and it says, the Hispanic vote delivers Texas to Trump. That indeed the suburban vote that Biden hoped to grow did grow in Harris County and other places in Texas. But that where the Biden campaign lost Texas was with the Hispanic vote. Not only the Hispanic vote, Nestor, which is perplexing you a bit, the Hispanic vote in the South along the border. So Trump's immigration message, whatever we think it is, however jumbled, appears to have resonated with Latino voters along the border, and yet it may be Latinos that deliver Arizona to the vice president. So Barry, this is an alphabet soup. Sorted out.
Well, to me, it probably speaks a lot to the money being spent there politically over the course of 30 years. And quite frankly, whether you're following the Federalist or whether you're following MSNBC on your phone, you know, literally, for those people, wherever silo you fell into, my family's from Venezuela. I got cousins that think one completely far left, and I have cousins that think completely far right, and they all come from the same pot of awfulness in Venezuela.
Yeah, but if you look at we keep referring to the Latino vote, the Latino community. Latinos subdivide in so many different ways. They subdivide by their country of origin. And they also subdivide by their religion. You know, most Hispanics are Roman Catholics. And they're conservative Roman Catholics. Probably half of them want to go back to the Latin Mass. In addition, the Hispanic culture is a macho culture, so that the men in Hispanic society can identify with the macho charisma of Donald Trump.
And that hurt Hillary greatly, right?
Oh, absolutely. To vote for a woman for president, and that's true of across the board. A lot of white college-educated women didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. But that's a topic for another day. You know, but the Latino vote, you know, is fractured, and we don't recognize that. You know, it's totally different in a place like California than it is in Texas, than it is in South Florida, compared to the Puerto Rican community in the Orlando area, which votes Democratic. So, you know, we make a mistake of saying, oh, the Latinos, well, you know, they're just gonna go, you know, one way or another in this election. It's not that simple. It's not that simple as, you know, the Democrats found out in Florida.
Barry, going back to, well, let's stick with that a little bit in terms of who we are. One of the things that I've been grappling with is that it might be that, and this is nothing new, those of us who've been Democrats know we love to get down in the weeds and love to be policy wonks and love to convince the multitudes that our policy positions are right. Is one of the possible scenarios here that it's big picture gut feelings that matter more? You used that macho example for the president resonating with a certain...
Yeah, that has nothing to do with policy or taxes or anything.
It has nothing to do with any of that.
Makes me feel good. It makes me feel good.
Right. It seems to me that one of the big picture gut feelings that Democrats have to figure out how to address is this sense of the public is that Democrats don't love the flag nearly as much as Republicans love the flag, and that Democrats prefer criminals to cops. Now, both of those issues are much more complex, but that's the billboard. Is there something to that, Barry, that big picture gut where the Democrats just don't get it? They don't understand how to have that come into the dinner table in Dundalk, in Colgate, in Eastwood, in those places we know.
As you know, Don, a large portion of the Democratic Party national leadership has just given up on the working class American, unless that working class American is part of a minority group, the underclass. Their goal is to address the problems of the underclass. And, you know, let's face it, that, you know, that should be a priority. But what about the rest of us? And that's what those who are voting Republican, you know, would say. What about the rest of us? And that's where the Democratic Party is going off the tracks. And unfortunately, you know, the what many Americans see in the Democratic Party is a party that panders to African Americans, to Latinos, to gay and lesbian groups.
What they call identity politics, right, Barry?
Exactly. It's identity politics. Of course, Republicans do the same thing, but in a different way. But the problem, the mirror image is the Republican Party's problem with the far right. Because are they going to be captured? Is the Republican Party going to be captured by the Donald Trump-style extremism of the far right wing of their party?
Well, it drips of white nationalism, and, you know, very rarely do we even know who the Nazis in the country are voting for or pulling for. You know, they I don't think they were fans of Reagan, let's say, you know what I mean? Or either of the Bushes for the most part. But
there's a difference, Nestor. There's a big difference, because Ronald Reagan knew how to stand up to them and keep them in a corner. He basically played teacher and said, go to the corner and face the wall, little boy, you know, and he could do that. In today's world, you don't have strong leadership in the Democratic ranks, for instance, to say to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, go to the corner, little girl, and stop misbehaving. We have to run a government here. We have to sit down at the table and negotiate so you only get a part of what you want, not the whole loaf. And the hope here is that if there is a President Biden, that we can return a bit to more centrist, pragmatic problem solving, which draws together people from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And I think the coronavirus, which will still be a problem when Biden takes over, may be the reason that we have this kumbaya moment. And Biden, being a true bipartisan politician, he may be able to push that forward. And, you know, the future may not be quite as gloomy as it looks right now.
Well, the one thing I would say is over the next 60 days, you know, if there is going to be a transition, and for our purposes, we would speak of it in such a way that the big concern here would be, I think, for everyone, and they don't think about things internationally, is how we've been weakened as a nation if this thing goes into the courts, if he puts militias together, if bad stuff starts happening. I mean, we saw Biden's bus get run off the side of the road in Texas. You know, guys waving machine guns. I that is the concern for me, is how does China, how does North, Iran, Russia, all of these, and what do our former allies, I guess I have to say they're former until, you know, we figure out how to get back in and figure this whole thing out and say, like, that these 4 years were like a Newhart episode, you know, they just went away. I'm worried about the next 60 days, Barry. Your thoughts on that, because I think we are, that's the unprecedented part of this for who this guy is and what it will mean for the next 60 days in the middle of the plague, if we get Joe Biden to the steps in January and we have a transition of government that we're accustomed to here over 250 years.
Hey, Barry, before you respond, Nestor, I love that question. I think, and we're going to have Barry back on to talk about polls. We'll do a whole day on polls and what it means for the polling industry. We can't do that in the minute or two that we have left. But adding to Nestor's concern, Barry, of the next 60 days, assuming that Biden wins, and this gets to Nestor's question about the next 60 days, do you see a scenario where Trump, in true TV production mode, says, I was screwed, excuse my French, those of you listening out there with small children, I was screwed, therefore, I'm out of here, Mike, you've got this, I'm not even sticking around. So tie that into Nestor's next 60 days and take us out of here with your observations on that.
Yeah, the next 60 days are really perilous, very perilous, because you have a president who has a narcissistic personality disorder. You know,
and no control and no editor and no real concern, right? I mean, I don't think we get to the edge and think, oh, in the end, okay, he's just going to leave. I mean, and I think Bill Maher's been talking about that for 3 years, right?
Right. He's not going away, and he doesn't want to leave the White House. We don't know if he's going to barricade himself in the White House and say, it was a fraudulent election. As far as I'm concerned, I'm still president. We don't know if he's going to actually get the Supreme Court in some bizarre way to push Trump's agenda that he should be put in the presidency for another 4 years, regardless of the outcome of the election. We don't know what Trump's going to do. And it could be that it boils down to the people around Donald Trump, his chief of staff, who used to be in Congress, understands that there's a certain level of responsibility here. Mitch McConnell will be advising the White House to play the game more fairly. There are a number of cabinet officials that understand that, yes, there does have to be a transition. The government still has to function. The Department of Defense still has to protect this country. The intelligence agencies still have to protect this country. And we have to prepare the next administration's officials and cabinet officers for when they take over. So we have to cooperate. A lot's going to depend on this second and third level of the White House administration, understanding that they have a responsibility. As for the president himself, Donald Trump, you just have to hope that people can calm him down. One of the positives right now is that he's so locked up in winning an almost unwinnable election fight that he will probably be totally focused on that for the next 30 to 60 days. But in the meantime,
so will his supporters, by the way, when they're showing up at the Michigan State House, and that's the real concern, right? What he would incite at 2 o'clock in the morning with his mobile device is truly inconceivable at this point, right? It cannot be conceived.
Well, one of the real dangers here is that he's still getting guidance from Stephen Bannon. And Stephen Bannon, believes that the best thing is to blow the whole thing up.
Right.
And that may be what Trump tries to do over the next 3 months. And it could be that when Joe Biden finally takes office, everything is in tatters. the good news is that even if everything's in tatters, he can start rebuilding from the ground up. But we have to get to that point. And as I said, it's nervous Nelly time.
Barry, really appreciate you coming in. Go ahead, Don.
Go ahead now. I was going to throw it back to you. I was going to say, Barry, we really appreciate you being a regular contributor to Baltimore Positive. You always make us a little smarter. You give us you go to what I call that 10,000 feet level. As I said, we're gonna have to do a whole day on just polls. We'll bring some of the pollsters on, like to have you talk about it, because my goodness, they can put whatever lipstick they want on that pig, but I think they missed it. So, Nestor, take us out of here.
And for the 30th consecutive year, Arbitron has rated us a zero here at the WNST. And I know my mother used to listen, so, and my son listens sometimes in the car. Barry Raskivar joining us here. You can find him out writing and opining. And, of course, Don Moeller, our former Baltimore County executive and our partner here at Baltimore Positive. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.